This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. John Williams here, as is Michael Miller, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University. Always a very helpful guest. Welcome back, Michael. Happy holidays.
Oh, happy holidays to you, John. It's great to be on again.
It's not great to be on. The market's in the tank.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, the market's not life. It's just part of living.
Well, that's
some
a nice
up, some down.
That's a nice perspective, really. I mean, just catch your breath, folks, and appreciate the fact that you're here still vertical and and that things will get better. And really, we've been through worse, right, Michael?
Exactly right. You know, a lot of people, I think about back to 2008 when we, you know, I think my wife and I, our retirement fund went down by something like 40%. And at the time it was just, oh my gosh, look what's happening. But, you know, that's a long gone memory. All that has been regained and we're doing much better now. And of course, now we're having a downtime, but on average we're up. And so invest, take some risks, and over time you'll do better.
Do you think that Paul Volcker's comments were appropriate? Or Paul Volcker, do you think that Chairman Powell's comments were appropriate?
Wow. You know, I think I have some differences with the chairman over this. When you look at monetary policy, you have to think of two pieces to it in terms of the way it's done right now. One is interest rates, and they clearly have increased interest rates enough that they're affecting spending. And we're seeing that with retail sales and industrial production and other things. We're seeing declines, which is what the Fed is trying to create so that they can reduce, in a sense, the demand side. But at the very same time, they're reducing the amount of liquidity by selling off part of their portfolio, and they're draining dollars out of the banking, out of the system. So when you combine those two things, I think the monetary policy situation is actually tighter than the interest rate shows, and I think that the Fed is overdoing it. And I think they did this in 2008. They raised rates one or two times too often, or too many. And I think they're what Powell did is essentially tell people, we're going to, even if it creates a recession, which is probably going to occur, we're going to kill inflation, and we're going to raise rates faster than you think we are.
Well, you don't think that they should not have raised rates this time. Are you?
No, I'm okay with this one. But if you do look at the inflation figures that came out earlier, we do see that we're down year over year, which is good. But what is very important at this point is how are we adding to the inflation from month to month? And we only added, prices went up only 0.1% compared to the month before. And if you annualize that, that's not even 2% inflation. That's a very low rate of additional inflation, which means that the Fed is making really decent progress. And to me, that's a sign that monetary policy, new additions to the interest rate, should slow down, in part because monetary policy takes 6 months to a year to have its effect. It takes a full 2 years, actually, for the full effect to be felt. But most of the effect occurs within the first year. And so we're still having effects from interest rate increases of months ago. And I think that those are all baked into the cake already, and that the Fed should, I think, slow down their aggressiveness and
That means slow down their aggressiveness means that next year, suggest anyway, that you won't raise them as many times or as much, right?
That's correct. But see, Powell was, I thought, relatively aggressive. He was saying, yeah, they're going to go up, and they may go up more than you think they're going to go up. I think this is what he's wanting us to take from that. And I'm not so sure that that's the right message.
We're talking to Michael Miller on the Wintrust Business Lunch, the Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul. There's a few other things I want to talk to you about, Michael, but I just want to read this text message from 708. I know you're not a financial planner per se, but this listener says, I'm retired and watching my retirement funds decrease. When they run out, I have to live on Social Security. I'm losing years of funds. What do you say about a message like that, Michael?
He's absolutely right, but there's one thing that we, you know, and I'm at that age as well. I'm going to be 70 this coming summer. And you need to have a portfolio that is going to combine risk and return at a rate that you can find acceptable. And so if he is losing money that dramatically, there's a chance that he is too aggressively invested. And so he should probably see a financial advisor and make sure that he has the right portfolio for his age.
If he can survive on the funds he has or is getting, say, from Social Security without tapping into what I presume are equities here in his retirement fund,
right.
They recover and then you don't really lose. But the question is, how long can you hold out before you tap those, especially if you have minimum required distributions? But when do you think the market returns then, Michael?
Well, of course, the market is always anticipatory. It tends to turn up before the economy does. A lot of people are talking about a weak first half of 2023, and therefore you would expect that the market may hit bottom sometime in the first half of 2023 and start back up. And I can only hope for myself as well, because if my retirement fund is down 12%, it would have been down considerably more, say 10 years ago when I was more aggressively into stocks. But now that I'm older, I have a more a safer portfolio. But of course, I don't make as much money when the market does go up.
Yeah.
And that's the give and take. There's always a trade-off.
Well, I'm putting my Terry Savage hat on now.
Yes.
If you're 70 and...
Chicken money.
There you go.
Yeah.
But I'm not even talking about that. I mean, if you're 70 and think, I'll probably live to be 90, and you probably will, that's 20 more years. I mean, this is a buying opportunity right now, the market generally.
That is correct, because when prices are low, if you have a certain number of dollars you can invest, they call that dollar cost averaging, you end up buying a larger number of shares. And when those shares then go up, you have quite a return.
You and producer.
So this probably is a good, if there is some spare money sitting around, this is probably a good buying time.
And if you have the time, and by that I mean your time horizon.
Right, the time horizon.
You and producer Pete were talking, and you said low-skilled people who have repetitive jobs have been replaced by machines, and their market options have been reduced. Now, that's not news to me.
No.
But it does show that people on the lower end of the educational or economic spectrum are feeling the job crunch or the wage crunch maybe more than other people right now, right?
That's correct, because we've known this a long time, but we always, redo studies to make sure these concepts still fit. And a guy named Lazier and some co-authors wanted to study across a number of countries to find out, is there a connection between productivity, that's how much value you bring to the firm, and the wage you receive? And the answer is yes. And therefore, the obvious implication is the more you can bring to the market, the more productive you are, the more that you will be paid. And that's why economists have always been, for example, such big fans of education and training. Not necessarily college. I mean, just learning how to drive a truck, how to weld, and so forth. Mm-hmm. That when you have those skills, you bring them to the market, and you will be compensated for that. So when you have a repetitive job, machines now, because of robots, can take those jobs, and therefore you've got to be trained in other activities so that you can become valuable to the market.
There's kind of a twist to this story, though, right?
There is, and I had never thought of it this way. And what they looked at was what could be the influence going forward of artificial intelligence. And this is where, of course, computers can kind of think and do things that we thought computers could never do before. And the implication that these guys are coming up with in their research is there is a chance that in the not too distant future, that AI, as it becomes much more interactive, is going to be able to replace the jobs of even people at the high end of the income scale.
Yeah,
it won't be just people in repetitive jobs. It will be in jobs, maybe even something, for example, like investing. You'll no longer need an investor, an advisor. You'll simply have an algorithm through AI that will tell you exactly how to invest. And therefore, companies that have all of these financial advisors, they're going to have to find, they're going to have to learn to code, to use the expression we use today. They're going to have to learn to do something else. And I thought, boy, that's a, you know, we always think of the people at the top as safe, that if you're well-trained and you have a job that requires a lot of education, that there's not a chance that that job's going to disappear. And AI just might be something that could put some of those jobs at risk.
It's funny because any of us who have used a chatbot before, I'm on a website trying to get some satisfaction, a box pops up and says, hey, what are you trying to do? Can I help you? You type in what you want, and then there's an algorithm that sees the words, and then it spits out helpful information, in theory. I don't know that the, I think it's very hit or miss with that, but that's what we're talking about. Normally, that would be a human in real time, and now it's not. Would you say that there's, for plumbers, welders, electricians, carpenters, I think that there's plenty of opportunity and revenue for skilled trades right now, don't you?
Oh, absolutely the case. I mean, you still have to come out and you have to install the wiring. You have to be able to frame. You have to do the roofing. So there are certain jobs. I mean, there are also jobs which can be very dangerous, and they take training. You can't just become a carpenter. I mean, it takes, what, 5 years to be a true apprentice and become a carpenter? But see, those are the kinds of things that economists have always said, is that it doesn't necessarily mean you have to go to college. You simply have to be valuable to the market. Either you have a talent, like you can play hockey, or you learn a skill through something like welding or carpentry, or you go to school and you become a scientist and things like that. Just bring value to the market and you will be compensated for your value.
I got a better chance of playing in the NHL than I do figuring out how to do plumbing. So if you're a plumber, hats off to you, because we need you. Thank you for doing what you do.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you too, Michael Miller. I'm out of time, but happy holidays to your family, sir.
And to you as well, John. I'll talk to you, I hope, in the new year.
Oh, that's a plan. Dale Buss, veteran financial journalist, the founder of an organization called the Flyover Coalition. Dale follows businesses and encourages Midwest investment in business news. And he joins us again on WGN. Hi, Dale. Welcome back.
Thanks, John. I'm bringing you a never-before-heard on the radio or anywhere else exclusive today. I hope you know that, right?
I don't. I know what you want to talk about. What's up your sleeve, sir?
Well, the Flyover Coalition, you know, the whole purpose for what we do is to bring regional governments, companies, everybody together to try to promote our region. But there's always been a lot of resistance to that idea when it comes to economic development, because everybody's out for their own, right? Every city and state is out for their own. I mean, latest example, perfectly relevant to Chicago, is what Governor Pritzker is doing in trying to go after the Stellantis EV business, hoping that he can get the company to replace what it used to make, or what I think what it still is making, the Jeep Cherokee in Belvedere, with a giant EV plant and even a battery complex, because Stellantis is very far behind the rest of the industry in that. And he's rolling out the idea of new incentives and everything, which you know about. But what's happening is that on the strength of all of the multi-billion dollar investments that companies have announced for the upper Midwest, both in the EV business and in the microchip business, we've got some Midwestern governors saying, hey, what if we promote the region as a whole? What if we say, hey, we've got a lot of stuff, exciting stuff here happening. We'll work together. We get more swings at the plate. We get more possibilities in the funnel, and then everybody kind of gains from that. And that's exactly the kind of thing that the Flyover Coalition has been promoting, and a few other people. But it just hasn't happened at this point, and it seems like it may be happening. What my sources are telling me is that Governor DeWine of Ohio and Governor Holcomb of Indiana are going to kick this off, and they're trying to wrap the Democratic governors of Michigan, Whitmer, Illinois, Pritzker, and Evers of Wisconsin into it, and maybe Andy Beshear of Kentucky, and they're going to be talking about this early in the coming year. You know, how do they promote the region effectively to make it better and more attractive for everybody? And I think that's pretty exciting if they actually step up to the plate like that. They should have done it long ago.
Do you think the Democrats will work with the Republicans and vice versa?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, everybody's got their real – every governor in the region got reelected, right, who was running. And Beshear is running in 23. They have an off-year election in Kentucky. But that's the point. The people I know in the economic development community are telling me, okay, they don't have to worry about getting reelected. So how do they take best advantage of the opportunities that basically have been dropped in front of them by how companies like Intel are planning investing tens of billion dollars in Ohio, other chip companies planning in investing in Indiana and elsewhere, automotive companies investing in Kentucky, Tennessee, again, Indiana, Michigan. Wisconsin's been missing out a little bit because of how they screwed up Foxconn. But, you know, even Illinois, with all of its high cost, you know, public pension challenges, high taxes, all that stuff, you know, may have a legitimate shot at getting a big EV footprint at the Belvedere plant. So, but there's so much more out there and so much more to be gained by promoting the entire region as the best place to do this kind of manufacturing because of the talent base, mm-hmm. because of water, because of the transportation infrastructure, because of, you know, the Big Ten and other land-grant universities that have all this engineering and technical talent available. It's just never been packaged effectively, and that's what, you know, I've been advocating for a long time, and I'm told that, you know, this may be happening on the basis of what these governors might be doing.
What's the mistake that Wisconsin made with Foxconn?
Well, Scott Walker, you know, really wanted to be able to land this for his state, and I think it was just a mistake of maybe not knowing the Taiwanese very well, the company that, you know, that's behind Foxconn, or the company is Foxconn, I guess. You know, there was a lot of froth, a lot of enthusiasm. But very early in the game, Foxconn said, well, we're not going to do what we thought we were going to do. We thought we were going to make huge glass screens. And they said, not a good market. So I think it was just a little unfamiliarity with who they were dealing with, and that's very unfortunate. But the companies that are kind of spraying around these projects that I've been talking about, you know, there are really no questions about them, right? Intel, Ford, General Motors, Toyota, they're well known. So
yeah, those are better known commodities. So if, say, Chicago or Bloomington, Indiana were to land one of these things, you say that it's better if we all pull together in some fashion, and that makes sense to me, particularly since you cite some examples. For instance, Amazon's HQ2. Talk about that for a second and how big of a deal that was. You said
that's
that was
a perfect example of how this can work. I was talking to Steve Case about this. He's the founder of America Online, and he has the Rise of the Rest, a book that he just put out. You know, he did these bus tours a few years ago around the Midwest, trying to promote venture capital investing in our region. And he said, look, when everybody was going after Amazon HQ2 several years ago, one reason that the D.C. area got it is that the Maryland and Virginia governments and D.C. worked together. They said, irrespective of where you put this place in the region, we will work together. And partly because of that they ended up getting the 20,000 jobs that Amazon promised for that headquarters. The thing to remember is, while we seem to be well positioned in the upper Midwest and the Mid-South for all of this, there are competing regions of the country who would love to have and have the chance to get some of these projects. I mean, Arizona is big in chips. You don't have to go too far out there to get to Nevada, where there's a Tesla plant and a big battery factory. So they have potentially a big footprint. And of course, you know, Mexico is emerging in the automotive space, and then there's China. So it's not as if we've got it in the bag in this region, and we just divide up the spoils. We have to get more. We have to emerge as the place for these types of manufacturing going forward.
If you read the flyovercoalition.org, flyovercoalition.org, you'll see politicians finally embrace the need to promote region. All right, Dale. I'm glad you've been flying this flag along. Hopefully others will fly it, too. It's good news that way, at least hopeful news. Thank you, Dale.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, and Merry Christmas.
Yeah, you too. Flyovercoalition.org. That's Dale Buss. More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch now with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Goose Island Beer is moving its brew pub from Clybourne Avenue to the new Salt Shed Entertainment venue at the site of the former Morton Salt Complex on Elston Avenue. Crane says the new Goose Island space will open by the end of next year. The location at 1200 West Blackhawk will be smaller but have an open layout and large patio. Goose Island Beer has been on Clyburn for nearly 35 years. Salt Shed is a live music venue that opened earlier this year. Chicago candy giant Mars will use its charity arm to provide funding for dental care for underserved children in Asia. According to Cranes, the Mars Wrigley Foundation will spend up to $18 million for dental care through its Healthier Smiles program in conjunction with Save the Children. The areas where the assistance is targeted are located in regions where it does business with mint and cocoa growers. It could help 8 million or more children in Indonesia, the Philippines, and Vietnam. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Let's do the business of food, and Steve Alexander.
And we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. If you drive your Chevy to pick up a Christmas tree this weekend, you may notice a couple of things. The cost of trees, real trees, is higher, roughly 20% over last year, and there may not be as many to choose from. Here's why. While corn and soybean farmers can be planning now how many acres they're going to plant next year, Christmas tree farmers can't because trees grow slowly. It can take as many as 15 years to grow a 6-foot tree, and there's no way to know if
what's happening now is the case for 8 years out.
Tree farmer Jim Gelson says back around 2010, when we were all going crazy for artificial trees, tree farmers cut back on their planting, and here we are now with a smaller supply. Now farmers are planting more again, rolling the dice and hoping the demand is there when their trees are ready. It's a risk, something all farmers are familiar with.
But it's calculated risk, so you've got an idea of where your return is, what your odds of return are.
The National Christmas Tree Association says about 350 million trees are currently growing on Christmas tree farms in the United States, and 25 to 30 million are sold each year. He says all 50 states do grow trees, but the big two are Oregon and North Carolina. We get a lot of ours in the Chicago area from the Tar Heel State. Michigan and Wisconsin are in the top five. Indiana is number 16. The Land of Lincoln comes in at 18. And farmer Gelson says planting Christmas trees can be a great investment.
If you get trees for 20 cents a piece, I'm going to put 5,000 Norway spruce out in the spring. That's $1,000. In 12 years, they'll be worth $1 million. What else can you invest in to get a return like that?
Now, Gelson says some farmers are jumping on the hemp bandwagon, figuring that a crop that grows at the speed of light compared to trees is a better deal. But he's not going there.
No, because that's an unproven market right now.
From the farm to your belly, tomorrow is National Maple Syrup Day. You know, some of the best maple syrup I've ever had came from Orion's homeland, the Kickapoo Valley in southwestern Wisconsin. Enjoy your weekend. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Let's talk with Lynn Osmond, the president and CEO of Choose Chicago. Hi, Lynn. Welcome back.
Hi. It's great to be back here.
Speaking of food, Restaurant Week is right around the corner next year, and you guys have a first kind of a bite event that sort of previews it. Tell me about that.
Well, we have Restaurant Week kicks off First Bites on Thursday, January 19th, and it's from 6 to 9 at the Field Museum, and it's the official kickoff. And so our head chef, our host chef for that, is Chef Darnell Reed of Lula's Southern Kitchen in Lincoln Square. But then we have 50 restaurants participating, and they're going to be showcasing dishes from their some of their favorite dishes from their restaurants. And all the funds from this actually go to support two beneficiaries, Kitchen Possible, which helps kids to empower them to think about cooking and being chefs, and then the James Beard Foundation Scholarship Program. So really a fun event and a great way to eat your way through Chicago's restaurants all in one place.
How does that work when you do the First Bites event? And again, it's January the 19th, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Field Museum. Doesn't that sound like a fun venue and thing to do? So if I buy a ticket, then do I get a wristband? Do I pay per stop when I'm milling about? How do I do that?
No, once you buy your ticket, you're good to go. It's like an all-inclusive vacation, but it's all-inclusive eating. Yeah. And so you just get your wristband, and you will go from bite to bite, and you'll sample some of your favorite food. You'll also have a variety of beverages that are being offered. We have beverages, sponsors, and just specialty drinks. So it's really, it's just like giant food festival. And, of course, you know, when else do you get to go eat at the base of Sioux? So it's really fun to be wandering around.
At the base of Sue. Oh, I get it. Yeah, sure, as in the dinosaur. I thought it was Sue, another chef I haven't heard about. So Kitchen Possible. Kitchen Possible, it's an organization that this will benefit, offers eight-week sessions throughout the year for the youth in underserved areas, Pilsen, Englewood, East Garfield Park. The kids learn life lessons firsthand through cooking, setting goals, patience, asking for help, celebrating success. It's $115 if I buy my ticket right now, right?
It is, and tickets will sell out. So if you're interested in going, I definitely recommend that you purchase these tickets. And since we're coming up on the holidays, what a great gift give to somebody, the gift of food.
And nobody's doing anything Thursday, January 9th. We're all done with Christmas. Everything's put away.
January 19th, not January 9th.
Even more maybe opportune because we will be done with the holidays and anxious for something to do. And then restaurant week then would start the next day, right?
It starts the next day on the Friday, and it goes until Sunday, February 5th, and it's the 16th annual event. And it takes place over 17 consecutive days. So very cool. And it's got, go on.
Well, I just noticed 330 Chicagoland eateries are participating this year.
Yeah, it's great. And you know what I love about it is that there are eateries from 34 different neighborhoods. And we've got 37 suburban restaurants, which is a real expansion from what we've done in the past. 51 restaurants are making their debut. And then 55 restaurants are minority owned. So what I really encourage people to do is to go to our website, Choose Chicago, looking at Restaurant Week. But, you know, go and explore a different neighborhood. It's a perfect time to explore different cuisines, different neighborhoods. Mm. What I love about the way the website's organized, you can go, you can scroll it by neighborhood, you can scroll it by cuisine, and it really is an opportunity to go beyond your comfort zone, go beyond that regular restaurant that you go to all the time and do something different. And, you know, it's great because lunch and brunch is $25, and then dinner is a multi-course prefix menu, and dinner is $42 or $59, depending on your location. So, you know, reasonable prices to get a three-course meal.
Starting January the 20th through Sunday, February 5th, restaurant week this year is 17 consecutive dining-packed days. This is great. And if you want to find out more about that, the website to go to is eatitupchicago.com, eatitupchicago.com. And the website for the First Bite event, where do I click on there? Eatitupchicago.com as well?
You can do Eat It Up Chicago. You can also go to Choose Chicago and just type in First Bite. So that, lots of different ways to find both of these events.
Good news. I'll see and you. Go ahead, Lynn, finish that thought.
Yeah, and I was just going to say you can also follow us at Choose Chicago and look at Chicago Restaurant Week, and that'll give you all the latest updates, new restaurants that are coming on, and you know, any new event activities.
It's all good to hear, Lynn. I'm anxious for it and anxious for you. Thanks for your time today.
You're welcome. Okay, thank you very much.
Lynn Osmond, President, CEO, Choose Chicago.